Well, hey, Crosspoint, it's great to be with you today. Again, my name's Kurt, if we haven't had a chance to meet. And if you're new today, here for the first time, welcome. We're in the six-week thing. And yeah, if you're here for the first time, you're not going to be lost. You're going to be able to pick up right with where we're going today. As you can see on the screens, it's amazing. There is a very distinct and intense differences between religions and spiritualities that come from all over the world. In fact, it's easy to see that not all religions are the same, and yet there are a number of unique similarities. For instance, all religions are trying to make some sense of purpose. How do I find my purpose in life? How do I make meaning out of life? How do I get to a better place? There's certain values or virtues that cut across all spiritualities. Things like it's good to generally tell the truth, or it's not good to kill somebody in cold-blooded murder, and most generally agree on that. One similarity is that I lean into my own efforts, I lean into my understandings, my knowledge, I leverage the principle of karma. Whatever I do is eventually going to come back to me, and so I hope I have a little more good in my life than bad. And so ultimately, it's about my efforts, it's about what I can do and about what I'm supposed to do, and this is the law of fairness. Fairness. I tell you what, fairness cuts all across our society today. I don't know if you noticed this. You see in the news, even some of the headlines of the recent weeks, we have the college admission scandal that's going on with all these high-profile Hollywood types and people funding their kids' admission into colleges they shouldn't be at. And now they're getting sentenced. And now it's like, oh, the sentencing's unfair. They should get more time. Or why am I getting more time than the other person? We're always about unfairness. You may have seen the story this week about the Dallas police officer who was white, who killed a black man when she walked in thinking he was in her apartment. She got sentenced this week to 10 years, and as soon as the judge read that sentence, the black judge walked off the bench, gave the woman a hug, gave her a Bible, and everybody's crying, that's unfair, it's unfair. She wouldn't do that to anybody. I tell you what, presidential pardons. Every time a president leaves office, everybody decries, that's not fair. He gives presidential pardons to people who don't deserve it. I tell you what, you go to any little league venue in our city, you will hear unfairness all over the place, right? People are always crying out, this isn't fair, that's not fair. See, all of these are examples of how fairness comes into play and how we interpret these kinds of things in life. And this is one of the reasons that there's something that Jesus said that bothers certain people, some of us, so much. In fact, here's one of the things Jesus said. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And people are like, come on, why, how can that be? I mean, that's like the ultimate religious snobbery right there. Seriously, that Jesus is the only way? Because we want it to be balanced. We want it to be fair across all religions. All religions have some appropriate pathway to get to God. And so for many of us, this statement of Jesus just rubs us the wrong way. Jesus did actually say that. We learned that last week. If you weren't here last week, and go back to the podcast and understand how we know the things in the Gospels are very valid. And so we're certain that Jesus said this. We're also, it also could be that what Jesus said was wrong. I mean, that certainly could be the case. But the idea we're going to look at today is the heart behind what he said right here. And so as we do that, I just want you to know right off the top, I'm not interested in defending Christianity, all right? I have no energy for that. There's a lot of things that have been done in the name of Christianity over the years that I'm not proud of, that I don't want to really be a part of in any way, shape, or form. And there were crusades done, centuries ago in the name of Christianity. There were, Christians who killed each other back in the 15th, 16th century all over the method of baptism. I mean, crazy. There's racial things that have been done all under the name of Christianity. It's funny, whenever I meet someone for the first time, they're like, hey, what do you do? I usually don't lead with I'm a pastor. That's usually just not my first line. I'll say something like, I'm a spiritual coach, or I'm a part of community transformation. And eventually they're like, huh, like, what is that? Is that like a pastor? And eventually, yeah, it's a pastor. Which sometimes just ends the conversation right away. Other times I'll hear something like, well, I don't really believe in God. And it's funny because people expect like I'm going to be surprised by that. I'm usually not surprised by it at all. In fact, I'll usually say, well, tell me the kind of God you don't believe in, because I may not believe in that God either. And they'll say, well, I don't believe in a God who da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And often say, yeah, I don't believe in that kind of God either. What else you want to talk about? I just don't have much energy or time to defend. And it really doesn't need our defending. But what I've been discovering is that there's so many people who were not really clear on who the person of Jesus is. And so that's what this whole journey is about, is trying to reboot our assumptions on the most influential figure that ever walked the earth. And I don't expect us all to believe everything you hear or to understand everything. everything you hear as we're talking about this, or even to agree with everything, but we're sharing these things hoping that certain things do land in our lives and we have to wrestle through that. So people have always had a hard time understanding followers of Jesus, even all the way back to the first century, because they didn't do like normal religious activities. So even in the first century, people were like, we don't know how to categorize followers of Jesus. They'd say something like, well, where's your temple? You know, where's your temple where God dwells? And the early followers of Jesus said, well, we don't have a temple. Like, we don't need a building or a place for God to dwell. He actually dwells in us. His spirit dwells in us. And like, really? We don't get that. Well, if you don't need a temple for God's dwelling place, how do you do sacrifices? Like, where do people bring their animals for sacrifice? And the early Christians say, well, we don't do sacrifices anymore. And they're like, really? I don't do sacrifice? No. See, this real unfair thing happened to Jesus on the cross. He went to the cross and was crucified, not for anything he did, but for the sins of the world. So he became the perfect Lamb of God. And so he actually created a new covenant, so we no longer have to do the sacrifice thing. Oh, you don't do sacrifices. Oh, my word. We don't know how to categorize you. Well, what do all the religious, you know, figures do? Like, the religious professionals do? You know, how do they, like, intercede between you and God if you don't have a place to gather that's a physical place? They say, well, we actually don't need religious professionals to intercede. We can actually go directly to God. Jesus made a pathway for that. And so, you know, people just look at them and like, we don't know what to do with you. In fact, early first century Romans actually thought Christians were atheists because they didn't fit any of the religious categories or systems that they were used to. And so, you know, followers of Jesus have always just been misunderstood, and people have always been bothered by Jesus. Because, see, in the religious system, it's all about tit for tat, and, you know, I get what I deserve, and this for that. It's all about, you know, fairness. And Jesus comes, and he plays on an entirely different field. And he says, I'm playing on a different plane, and setting a different spiritual plane or reality to operate in. And this is why he often got in trouble with people, because he wasn't into the religious systems. Which, speaking of religious systems, just a quick commercial. Three weeks from this past Thursday night is, I think, Nestle and Hershey's and maybe America's favorite holiday, the holiday of Halloween. And so our team has been wrestling through, you know, we got a Thursday night service. Do we do Thursday night service? Do we not do Thursday night service? And part of me is like, why would we not have Thursday night service? Because I put like Halloween in the realm of Valentine's Day. I'm like, we're not going to cancel service for Valentine's Day, right? I mean, we're going to be here. And yet we said, you know, we're not so religious that we got to be in church every time we have a service in this building, and we value even more you being not pulled out of the community on Halloween night, but you actually being in the community on Halloween night. In fact, the last two times my family has moved over the last 12 years, we've just happened to move over the week of Halloween, and it's really cool because like 2 or 3 days later, we get to go knock on all our neighbors' doors and introduce ourselves and trick-or-treat, and it's like normal. It's not like weird, right? So we're not going to have service on Halloween evening, the 31st of October. If you ever attend Thursday nights, we'll just have our Sunday services that weekend. And so we want you to be present and in your community that night, in your neighborhoods, being Christ with people around you. So where was I? All right, looking at the book of Luke. How many of us have been reading through the book of Luke? You've been doing your challenge this week? Yeah, I can't see here. Let me hear from you. You've been doing your challenges this week? Okay, good, because I can't see all your hands. The homework, which I hate the word homework, but I don't know what else to call it. I mean, you do it at home, and it does require some work, so thus it's homework, right? So these things are all leading us to new understandings, and so we're reading through the book of Luke, and I'm going to share a story today that came up in my reading this week. You may have or may not have got to it yet. It's a story I've read a lot, I've talked about a lot, but I've recently had some new learnings, some new understandings. I've kind of looked at this story through fresh eyes, partly due to a book called The Prodigal God by Tim Keller, which you're going to hear some out of this book today, and if you are not familiar with this book and you want to dig deeper, highly recommend this book for you. The scene of the story is Jesus spending time with two different groups of people. One group is the totally unreligious. These are people that are outside the spiritual circle. They do whatever the heck they want to do. They're not a part of any spiritual community. And then the other group is the religious group, who are always in the spiritual circle. In fact, they do very little outside of the spiritual circle. And so here's what it says in Luke 15, verse 1. It says, now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes sinners, and he eats with them, and he drinks beer from the bottle, and call girls, come to his side. Mutter, mutter, mutter. Because religious people, have you ever noticed all they do is mutter? It's always muttering. They're all upset with what Jesus is doing. I mean, they're all upset that he welcomes, you know, scandalous people and call girls to come hear the message of what he's doing. And they don't get it. They're like, well, Jesus, why are you always operating outside of the spiritual circle? They just didn't understand, and the religious leaders are real upset with him. So he tells three stories back to back to back. It's like the first one is about a shepherd who had some sheep, and he loses one of the sheep. And so when he loses the one, he leaves the 99 and he goes out in search of the one sheep. The second story is about a lady who lost a coin. She has 10 coins. She loses one. She leaves the 9 behind to go turn her house upside down in search of the one missing coin. So he's kind of implementing the rule of three. This is like marketing 101, you know, like boom, 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 rapid fire, three different examples to illustrate a point. And then he goes into this story about the son who was lost. And you might know this story as the prodigal son, the story of the prodigal son. That's not what Jesus called it. In fact, that's like, you know, what we've done as a title in the Bible is just a way to, so we know how to find the story. It would better be called the story of two sons, because it's really about two sons. And so we're going to talk about this story today, because it really talks about how Jesus is not fair, and how life is not fair, and how Jesus operates on an entirely different plane. And so here's the story. It says, Jesus continued, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had and set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. He went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and yet here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. So he got up and he went to his father. Now, there are two kinds of people in this room this morning. There's younger sons and there's older sons. We're going to identify with one of these two sons. There's actually three characters in this story, younger son, the eldest son, and the father. The father represents God. None of us are God, just so you know. You might think you're God, but you're not God. All right, so which, by the way, this is a parable, which this is a story that Jesus made up. It could have happened, but it didn't. But it's a story he uses to illustrate something that's really important to understanding the kingdom of God. And in this case, this is the longest parable of any of the parables he tells, which tells us there's something really significant that he's trying to communicate, something he's really passionate about, and that really reveals the character of who he is or the father is. And so the younger brother, he operates the way all of us do when it comes to operating out of fairness. He's like, you know what, this isn't fair. Here I am slaving away from my dad, all right, I'm doing my dad's business, I'm helping him build his estate, all the while the world's passing me by. I mean, you know, by the time my dad dies, I mean, I'm going to be old. I mean, I'm going to need Viagra to go out and enjoy myself. I need to get out of this place. Which, that's in the text, in case you're wondering. You just got to read between the lines a little bit, right? He's like, I want to enjoy my life. I want to enjoy my energy. I want to enjoy my virility. I want to enjoy, you know, everything that's out there for me. It's so unfair. Here I am building stuff for my dad, and I'm missing out. And so he goes to his dad, and he says, hey, Dad, I want my share of the estate, like, right now, please. Like, I want you to give me my share of the estate. Now, the father, you know, whenever a son would come and say something like that, which was not very often, you know, whenever he'd say, hey, I want my part of the will, you know, whatever I've got coming to me in the will right now, in essence, he's saying to his dad, Dad, I wish you were dead. I want you dead right now so I can get what's coming to me. That's what he's saying. Now, I don't care who you are. If you're a father, you never want to hear those words, right? But especially in ancient Middle Eastern, early first century Middle East, this was like very, very, you know, dishonoring. And so the dad, one of the amazing things in the story is the dad does it. He divests himself, which wasn't like going to a nice brokerage account or going into E-Trade and putting in a sell order. I mean, he would have had to go off and like sell land. He would have, if you were wealthy, your wealth would have been in land holding. So he had to go out and sell land. He liquidates some of his land. He gives the younger son what he had coming to him, even though the father hasn't died yet. And the son goes out and enjoys it. He women wines and songs it. I mean, he wastes it all on wild living. Before he knows it, he's run out of money. There's a downturn in the economy. He's now, you know, he's looking for a job. He's out living with pigs, and he's trying to just do menial labor, eating what the pigs eat. Now, in Jewish culture, this would have been like the low of the low. All right, if you're a Jew, pigs are not kosher. So this would have been like a fundamentalist hanging out on a porn set. That's like how bad this was, right? Or like a vegan in a butcher shop. Like they just don't go together, right? And so he's eating what the pigs are eating, hanging out with the pigs, which is a sign of how far he's abandoned his religion of origin. I mean, it just shows how far he's gone. And then he has this moment where he goes, oh my gosh, my dad has laborers. I mean, I could go back and work for my dad and make more money than I'm making right here. I could go back and learn a trade so I could actually be productive. And I don't deserve to stay in the main house. I mean, I forfeited that. I gave that up when I said, Dad, I wish you were dead. But certainly I could go back and just work as a hired hand. Because see, here's the interesting thing. When you play the fair game, you always have to play the fair game. Whenever you play the fairness card, then you always, you know, feel like you got to live out of the fairness card. And for him, you know, he's like, it's not fair. I'm wasting my youth. I'm wasting my virility. So he goes out and he takes his inheritance and he blows it all. And because he played the fairness card, he knows he cannot come back as a son. He's got to come back as a hired servant, just trying to make a living. He's like, I don't deserve living in my bedroom again. I don't deserve to have a spot at the table, at my dad's table. I don't deserve to, you know, take a dump on my dad's toilet. I mean, I lost all that. I gotta be out with the servants now. And this is what younger brothers are like. Younger brothers, I mean, you know, we're like, God's holding out on me. God, why do you keep holding out on me? I want what's coming to me right now. It's not fair. It's too boring to hang around, you know, the father. I mean, it's boring hanging around. I'm missing out on stuff. So younger brothers rebel. You know, it's like if I'm hanging around the father, I'm like living a loser life. I need to go out and I need to live my life. And he gets out there and then he realizes it's not all it was cracked up to be. I mean, he realizes there's a lot of pain out there, and sometimes the pain comes right away. Sometimes the pain comes later. But at some point, he begins to realize, man, I really kind of want to be reconnected with the father, but I don't know that that's possible because I did something and I'm just going to have to go back and work off my debt. And see, if you operate this way, if this is kind of how you generally think, I mean, you've probably never experienced the unfairness of our Heavenly Father. You've never experienced real mercy or grace. I mean, if you always think in terms of, well, I mean, I got to do the right spiritual thing, and I just got to play the part, and I've got to earn God's favor. If I blew it, I got to go make up for it. I mean, when we live this way, we're living on a different plane than the plane that Jesus operates on. I want you to take a look at one of our teammates' stories here from Crosspoint. He was generous enough to like share his personal experience on the unfairness side of God. Take a look at this.
You know, I am that. I am that son that went out. It took a lot to bring me to my knees, though. You know, it took having a gun put in my mouth. It took coming this close to death. I was pulled out of my house at gunpoint when I lived. I'm talking to you right now. You know, I should have died in that situation. You know, that to me is unfair. You know, that's unfair grace. God showed me grace in that situation. He showed me mercy in that situation. I didn't get what I deserved. Instead, I got what I didn't deserve, life. Yeah, because I think a lot of people have that misconception that, oh man, if I go to church, I have to have it all together. And that's one thing I love about this church, and you know, it's kind of the motto that has gone on, is that this is a place where you don't have to have it all together. When I was going through the hard time and I was going through that program, coming and knowing that I had Crosspoint to come back to, I mean, that, you know, to me was grace. You know, here I was coming to Crosspoint when I was in full addiction. I was here physically, but not spiritually, mentally at all. I was being drugged here basically by my wife. Thank God she did. But, you know, to come out of that program and to be welcomed back into this community with welcomed arms, and to be able to share my story with everybody. And you know, that just sharing your story is just more accountability. I'm glad I came to that point, because, you know, it sounds weird, but I don't have regrets. There's stuff, sure, that I wish I wouldn't have done, but I wouldn't know God like I know him now if it wasn't for the mess and the addiction that I went through. I know it's kind of vivid, but it's a picture of a guy with a needle in his arm, and God has got his arms wrapped around him, and God's taking the pain for him in that picture. You know, that one really hits hard for me. I don't see the God, the smiley, you know, holding the lamb. That's just not, you know, I see God as a loving God, but, you know, God is a serious God too. You know, we're all made in his image. We're all his children. Just like, you know, the story we're talking about with the prodigal son. I mean, you know, that's your son. And, you know, it's about taking ownership. You know, even if you go out and do these things, you know, if as long as you find a point where you can get to your knees and say, hey, you know, I messed up, I need forgiveness. And that's what it's all about. It's about unfair grace. It's about showing mercy. You know, the prodigal son, that's what that story is all about. I mean, you know, this one son's doing everything right, and the other son goes out and does everything wrong, but yet the father forgives the son that did everything wrong, you know, and that's grace. I mean, that's, you know, that's repentance. That's why we need Jesus. You know, the day I came to my knees, he was probably pretty happy. That's probably a picture of a smiling God, I would imagine.
Hey, take a look at those lyrics they just ended with right there. I've been every kind of loss that you can't find, but I got one thing right. That's the younger son right there. I mean, that is the younger son in the story. So the son, he starts making his way back to the father, and it says this. It says, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and he kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. I mean, he was every kind of lost right here, and now he's found. And understand, in that culture, lost didn't mean stupid like it does in our culture, right? Like, oh, they're so lost, they're stupid. No, this means like disconnected from a life-giving community, disconnected from a life-giving family. And I love the picture of the father right here. See, the father represents God. He sees a faint image on the horizon of his son. He can't even make out his face, but he knows his walk. And if you're a parent, a mom, a dad, I mean, as a father, I know my kids walk. I know their stroll. Last Saturday night, we were down in southern Indiana watching my son's cross-country meet at the state championship course. He ran in the freshman-sophomore race. There's about 300 kids. And we made our way halfway down the course, but they ran about 400 or 500 yards out across this field, and we weren't even close to him, but we're trying to pick him out. And we're watching, and then all of a sudden, I'm like, there he is, there he goes. Because I know my son's walk. I know his run. I know his glide. I'm like, that's my son. That's how the father is right here. The father, he so knows his son. He so knows and loves the son. He can't even make out his face, but he goes. He just like tucks his cloak in his whatever, and it's very undignified, and he runs toward his son. And I want you to think about this for a moment. I want you to ask yourself, what kind of facial expression do you think was on the father when he ran to his son? What do you think was on the father's face as he was sprinting toward his son? Or maybe a better way to ask that question is, you know, when you totally blow it, or maybe you blew it last night, and you're like, oh my gosh, God, I blew it. I'll never do that again. And then you blow it again the next day. What kind of facial expression do you think is on your Heavenly Father's face? Because see, however you answer that question probably says a lot about what you believe about the character of God. See, I think the look on God's face in that moment is kindness. His kindness just eludes, just comes right out of him, just comes toward his son. Listen, so many, we continue to see that God is this gracious, loving father who's so excited when we come to him. I don't think there's anything but kindness on his face. And listen, you're not big enough, I'm not big enough to wipe that kindness off his face. And so he sees his son, and he puts a signet ring on his finger, which, you know, shows his wealth. And it's basically saying, hey, son, my wealth is your wealth. He puts a robe on his son, which is basically saying, son, I want to clothe you with my identity. And then he says, let's kill the fattened calf because my son has been gone, and now he's home. Let's celebrate. He's like, there's no freaking way my son's going to go work for me. He's not going to be a hired laborer for me. He's my son. And he's given this unbelievable mercy and grace. Now, there's another version of this story in the Buddhist version of the Bible. And I want to read it for you because many other spiritualities have many of the same stories within their Bible, whatever their Bible is for their context. So let me read you a section of the Buddhist version. It says, his father, beholding the son, was struck with compassion for him. One day he saw at a distance, though through the window, his son's figure, haggard and drawn, lean and sorrowful, filthy with dirt and dust. He took off his string of jewels, his soft attire, and put on a coarse, torn, and dirty garment, smeared his body with dust, and took a basket in his right hand, and with an appearance fear-inspiring, said to his laborers, get on with your work, don't be lazy. By such means, he got near to his son, to whom he afterwards said, hey, my man, you stay and work here, do not leave again. I will increase your wages, give you whatever you need, bowls, rice, wheat flour, salt, vinegar, and so on. He's like, yeah, son, you can come back. Oh, man, it's good to have you back. You can work just alongside everybody else. In fact, if you read on in the Buddhist version, it says he had to work off his debt for 20 years to pay off what he had taken and squandered. See, that's what religions say. That's what's fair. Fair is fair. You rebel, guess what? You got to pay it off. You got to work it off until it's fully fulfilled. There's even forms of Christianity that operate this way. Can I tell you how many people I interact with that have had, as Dallas Willard said, painful, you know, bad spirituality explained and pursued, which creates painful human misery and rebellion against God, which is what happens when we misunderstand or have misunderstood or explained Christianity or who Jesus really is. We do these crazy, crazy things, thinking we had to do all this penance and I can never get out from under the thing that I did. And it's always held over my head and I can never really be a son or a daughter of the Heavenly Father again because I blew it 10 years ago, even though I've asked forgiveness like a dozen times. And see, for those of us younger brothers, this is so, so hard because it's hard to feel loved. It's hard to feel accepted because our fairness comes back to haunt us. We played the fairness card and it comes back to bite us. God can't really love me. There's no way you can do that. I mean, it's hard. See, for the younger brother, it's hard to accept and receive the unmerited love and the extravagant grace because that's totally opposed to the fairness model. So that's the younger brother right there. Then you have the older brother, or those of us who are older brothers, peering in on this story as well. So it says, meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing, so he called out to the servants and asked them what was going on. Well, your brother has come home, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. Notice the father goes out to both sons. But he answered his father, look, Dad, all these years I've been slaving for you. I've never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who squandered your property with prostitutes, didn't even need Viagra, he comes home, you killed a fattened calf for him. He's like, what's up with that? Dad, seriously. This is always the response of older brothers. See, older brothers don't openly rebel. Older brothers don't outwardly show their rebellion. They use their fairness to go a different way. But see, when they see somebody else getting something they don't deserve, when they see somebody else getting love, when they see somebody getting what should be, the older brother feels like should be coming their way or something they don't have, guess what sets in? It's bitterness. Bitterness just begins to spring up. See, older brothers are all about religious obligations. All about doing the right thing and making sure everybody sees that I'm always doing right. And so what the older brothers say is, I've been slaving for you. Dad, I've been slaving. Not like, Dad, it's been a privilege to work alongside you and partner in the furtherance of this estate that we have here. No, I've been slaving for you, Dad. I have no joy in what I've been doing. I have no personal connection with you. See, older brothers, it's always out of obligation. I've been slaving at Crosspoint. I've been doing two-year-olds for 3 years. Oh my gosh, I'm just slaving back there. Not like, oh my gosh, I get to help kids see Jesus. Or I've been slaving in the band for 10 years, slaving. Not like, oh my gosh, God, I'm experiencing your goodness and your joy that's just kind of filling me up and I'm helping people find their way back to God. But no, I'm just slaving. See, when we operate out of obligation, when we see somebody else get ahead of us, somebody else who's not been as faithful as I, who's maybe not done the things that I normally do, maybe I even see that I've been working harder, yet they get something that I feel should be coming my way, guess what happens? Bitterness just wells up. And all of a sudden, we're playing the fairness game now as well. Wait a minute, what do you mean he gets a fattened calf? Dad, I've been doing the right thing all these years. You didn't give me a goat to celebrate with my friends. What's up with that? So this is what older brothers do. There's a bitterness and an angst, and it saps our joy. See, it's hard to give grace to people who are doing things that you're not doing. And it's hard to give grace to people who are not doing the things that you are doing that you feel like they should be doing. And before long, that's when the bitterness and the anger, and we feel like God's holding out on me because I'm not getting what other people are getting. And this is what happens with older brothers. Again, they're not going to rebel outwardly, all right? They're not going to do the outward thing, but internally there's this, oh, and it enables us to begin to judge people. It enables us to begin to wish the worst for people. I mean, we're not going to do that outwardly because that would make us look bad, right? But I mean, inside, we're like cheering for people's failure inside. We're cheering for hard punishment for them. See, I'm an older brother, and I've also experienced older brothers, and it's not fun. It's not fun. A few years ago, I met with a pastor, just kind of out of courtesy. There was something I thought, you know, he might want to know about a situation that I thought, man, if I'm in this boat, I would want to know this. And so I met with him and started, you know, just shared a bit about this situation with him. And before long, he was patronizing me and trying to tell me all the things I did wrong. And here's why you're where you are. And I'm like, this is an older brother coming down on me. It is not fun. But see, that's what older brothers always do. They create angst. See, I'm a physical older brother. I'm also can be a spiritual older brother at times. Younger brother have their issues. Older brothers have their issues. But here's what I want us to see in this story. Here's one of my new discoveries on this. Both the older and eldest brother in this story are not, that they're completely opposed to the Jesus paradigm of grace. They're completely opposed to the Jesus paradigm of mercy and love. Now, something fascinating in these three stories. You know, the first story, a shepherd loses a sheep. He leaves the 99 and he goes out in search of the lost sheep. Second story, a woman loses a coin. She leaves the 9 coins behind, goes out in search of the one coin that she lost. But in this third story, nobody's leaving. I mean, the father, once he sees his son returning home up the path toward the home, he then goes out, and it'd be easy to interpret this and go, oh, well, the father, it almost looks like fairness. I mean, the father was waiting, and it's like once the son made the turn home, then the father will make his move, all right? So it's almost like God meets you halfway, all right? But that's not the story. That's not the story at all. See, God doesn't meet us halfway. Right, and there's something that people in this first century culture would have understood about the older and younger brother that you and I don't fully understand. All right, Jesus intentionally left something out of the story right here to cause them to look for this. See, to be the eldest son meant you would have gotten a lion's share of the inheritance, which means you would have got a majority. You would have got 2/3 or twice as much as the younger son. And so with that comes unique perks, and with that comes unique responsibilities as well. And so one of the responsibilities the older son would have had was to keep the family together. So it's the eldest son's responsibility to make sure that nobody that younger than him, none of his siblings, go out and leave the family. And yet that happens, and the older son, he's just hanging back. He's not doing any rescuing. He's not going out and funding the rescue of his younger son. He's just, or of his younger brother. He's just hanging back, waiting to see what happens. I don't know if you've ever heard the name Daniel and Donald Dawson. Anybody heard of Daniel and Donald Dawson by chance? I didn't know about him until I was reading the book Prodigal God. Tim Keller talks about him. In fact, they first were reported in Life magazine 1965, which, my word, look at Julie Andrews. I just saw her in a movie the other day. She's pretty hot when she was like 25, right? But in the upper corner, get off track there, it says, "Perilous Search for a Lost Brother." That's the headline I want us to see. Perilous Search for a Lost Brother. Donald Dawson, his younger brother Daniel, was a pilot during the Vietnam War. He went down behind enemy lines. Nobody heard from him, knew about his whereabouts. So Donald Dawson, he sells everything he has, and he goes to Vietnam to find his brother. He actually gets captured by the Viet Cong, put in jail, and then when they discovered what he was actually doing, they let him go and said, hey, let him go freely. Because there was something about the quest of an older brother looking for a younger brother that they held in high regard. In fact, among the Vietnamese, he became known as just simply the brother. Because that's what good older brothers do. They go in search of and fund the rescue of the younger brother. And see, in this story, This parable that Jesus is telling, he gives the younger brother a Pharisee for an older brother in hopes that this first century culture might go, ooh, that's not the way it should go. And they begin to long for the true older elder brother. In fact, what Jesus is wanting his audience to see is that he, in fact, is the good older brother. And when you begin to understand Jesus as an older brother, it begins to change the way we look at certain things that are talked about in the Gospels. I mean, when you begin to understand that the older brother is about going out and searching for those who are lost and bringing them back and funding the rescue, you begin to just read things differently, like Colossians chapter 1, verse 15, where Paul says, the Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. He's the firstborn. He's the eldest brother over all creation. Jesus goes on in Luke 19. For the Son of Man has come to seek and save. The Son of Man has come to rescue. The Son of Man has come to pay for the rescue of that which is lost. He's the eldest son. He goes out to seek and save which is lost. He comes to bring healing and restoration. So when we begin to look at Jesus and his role in the world as God's son, the eldest brother of humanity, we begin to look at him differently. And we begin to realize he operates not on the fairness plane, but he operates on an entirely different plane, the grace and mercy plane. And it brings new meaning to these things. Here's another one. The one who rejects you rejects me, and the one who rejects me rejects him who sent me. Now Jesus is saying, if you reject me, you reject God. And it's not like God's like, oh, well, you rejected my son, so I'm going to reject you. That's not what he's saying at all. He's like, you rejected the whole plan. If you reject Jesus, you rejected the whole plan. You got to see that my plan is not the earn your way back to me plan. It's not the do good things and see if you can be good enough to make your way to me. He says, my whole plan is that you don't want fairness. Trust me, you don't want fairness. Yet when you reject me, you actually reject the entire grace plan of our Heavenly Father. Here's one more. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now, doesn't that verse look a little different now that you understand the role of an eldest brother? I mean, it's no longer like, na, 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 na. Christians have Jesus. There's no other way for anybody else. It's not that, right? That's like the argument against this. No, this is Jesus saying, hey, if you want life, guess what? I came to fund the rescue. I came to pay for the rescue. If you want the way of grace, if you want the way beyond the bitterness and to get past, you know, being beaten down and all the pain and brokenness you've experienced, if you want the way of truth, I mean, if you're confused and you just need some clarity in your life, if you want the way of joy, where you don't have to work your tail off and bust your tail to earn your way back to God, if you want that kind of life, guess what? I'm here and I'm the way toward that life. See, there is a Jesus who is a good eldest brother for bad elder brothers. There's a Jesus who's a good eldest brother for bitter, violated older brothers. There's a Jesus who's a good eldest brother for driven, high-D, production-oriented church pastors like me, thank God. There's a Jesus who is an eldest brother who comes to people who attend Crosspoint at 9:30 on a Sunday morning. You maybe are just looking for a little more joy and to get out of the fairness game. And maybe that's what some of us need right now. In fact, I'm going to pray toward that end. Heavenly Father, we thank you for these three pictures, a picture of specifically these two brothers. And yet how you actually are the eldest brother that we long for. And you're the eldest brother that we need. You're the eldest brother that shows us that we both, whether we're a younger brother or an older brother, we have tendencies to get caught up in feeling like we don't deserve what you have for us. And we have this tendency to get caught in the fairness game, because once we play the fairness card, we always got to play the fairness card. Otherwise, we're a hypocrite. And this morning, Jesus, I just pray that for any of us that need, whether we're the youngest brother or we're more like the elder brother, the bad elder brother, God, we need a different plane to operate on. We need a grace plane. And so whatever that looks like for us individually right now, God, I pray that you would just meet us in that place. You would say what we need to hear. That you would show us that we don't have to keep working our way back to you by simply receiving. We get unearned, unmerited, scandalous mercy and grace. In fact, you loved us so much. Not only did you meet us halfway, but you came all the way. You you went to every dark place, you climbed every hill in order to reach us. And so God, I just pray that you would speak that identity and that grace and that mercy into our lives right now.